But one thing is, after this, I mean, we gotta.
Ladies and gentlemen on the floor, colleagues, comrades, and fellow travelers, my name is Greg Abrelles, Vice President and Midwest Regional Coordinator of the Platypus Affiliated Society. On behalf of the entire membership, let me welcome you to the closing plenary of our third annual convention. Last December, the President invited five economists to the Oval Office to discuss matters of policy. These were allegedly liberal economists, and the meeting was meant to indicate that the President was still listening to what is called, in American politics at least, the left. Even at the meeting, according to a recently published profile, quote, "These economists recognized what a paltry, Baudelaireized proxy for the left they were. Six academics, and by any broad ideological standard, a pretty moderate group, comfortable with markets and free trade." But liberals had long ago ceased to rally around class. In the United States, Blinder told me weeks later, a little bleakly, a little apologetically, there is no left left. The left that Blinder so bemoans, the broadly class-conscious left of the New Deal and the Great Society, was itself, of course, formed as a proxy for another left, the project of political Marxism. Thus, the situation may be different and more extreme than Blinder makes it out to be. Not only is there no left left, but the very echo of the left seems to be fading. To ask, as Platypus does, what is the legacy of Marxism today, may seem blindingly irrelevant. It is, on the one hand, an easy question to answer. Marxism's legacy has three discontinuous parts. First, as a vocabulary for research and interpretation in the humanities and contemporary art world. Second, as the ideological self-description of Marxist sectarian groups. And third, as a relatively meaningless populist denigration. Perhaps, though, the legacy of Marxism might lie in the future. If there is a hope aflame within the dark, black heart of Platypus, it is this: that Marxism might and must come to mean something for young people interested in politics. Do not be deceived by the apparent modesty of this project. It is among the many ironies of the present that the putative Marxism might turn out to be the highest enemy of Marxism itself. Or to put it in a different way, that the actually existing left might be standing in the way of the left to come. This is why Platypus orients its work around the critique of the left, and it is this critical orientation that continues, as might be expected, to generate the most resistance. For in its moments of great weakness, why criticize the left? Shouldn't we instead divert energies towards the critique of capitalism and the existing political order? In 1913, Lenin argued that three sources of Marxism, German philosophy, English political economy, and French utopian socialism, constitute the sources of the tradition. But whatever Marxism might be, it does not emerge as some sort of hybrid formation of the three. The three were, on the opposite, the objects of Marx's ruthless critique. Marx recognized that these three radically different activities each sought the recognition and transformation of the world. But the transformations had become aborted or failed, though still persisting. That is to say that they were symptoms, formations developed to resolve a problem that, instead, continued to obscure its recognition. Marxism developed by seeking to recognize these failures, to grasp their failures to attain their object. This formulation may cloak the political and emancipatory form of Marxism. Given the absence of the Marxist politics, there is a temptation to flatten out Marx into another progenitor of a research program. One says this is a Marxist reading in the same way that you would offer a Lacanian reading. What is missed here is the degree to which Marxism was a project of emancipation. Project and emancipation are now necessarily obscure. Platypus's work does not seek to provide a ready answer to that obscurity, but to ask it to recognize itself. In the tradition of closing plenaries at the Platypus Convention, we will devote this panel to a consideration of this problem by taking Platypus itself as one of the perhaps most acute symptoms of these problems. The panel will focus on the simple question, what is the Platypus critique? We'll proceed by hearing 15-minute presentations from our speakers, then opening up to a Q&A discussion. We'll first be hearing from Spencer Leonard, next Larry Rojas, and finally Ben Shepard, all of whom longstanding members of the Platypus Affiliated Society, who will bring to bear their experiences on the question at hand.
Comrades, our task today is to discuss and adopt a program. In undertaking this task, we are not motivated solely by the formal consideration that yesterday we formed a new independent organization and that a new organization must formulate an official program. Great historical moments have been the determining causes of today's deliberations. The time has come when the entire socialist program of the proletariat has to be placed on a new foundation. Comrades, in so doing, we connect ourselves to the threads which Marx and Engels spun precisely years ago in the Communist Manifesto. It might seem out of keeping with time and circumstance to identify the immediate task as the fulfillment of what Marx and Engels thought they might accomplish in 1848. Many might well condemn as reckless and premature a cause for the realization of the ultimate goals of socialism before an audience of persons dedicated to working through the meaning and aim of Marx and Engels' legacy, but hopelessly young and inexperienced. What must seem rash at any time cannot but seem altogether irresponsible when the political strength and acquisitions of a long period of preparation cannot be safely relied upon, and one is forced to rely on comrades whose enthusiasm and intelligence cannot compensate for other shortcomings. And yet, such was the revolutionary audacity of Rosa Luxemburg in 1918, when she demanded nothing short of the discarding of nearly three quarters of a century of historical regression. To recover the present via a return to the past, a return to the eve of revolution, manifesto in hand, a return to 1848. As she wrote, the course of the historical dialectic has led us back to the point at which Marx and Engels stood when they first unfurled the banner of international socialism. To find in the present a fulcrum by which to leverage the future, Rosa Luxemburg had to critique all history that separated her moment from the revolutionary past. Precariously poised as she was then, just weeks prior to her death, still she could honestly assure her comrades that while we stand where Marx and Engels stood in 1848, nevertheless we have the advantage that 70 additional years of capitalist development lie behind us. Though in retrospect we must note the irony that Luxemburg exuded such confidence in the value of history's lessons just a short time before the collapse of her party's forces and her resultant death, nevertheless, we must pause over the fact of this confidence. For Luxemburg had, with her comrades in the Second International, inherited and constituted the period intervening between 1848 and 1918 as history, as capitalist development, as she put it, in a way that we can only envy. For if in 1918 she was necessitated to constitute a socialist politics in the very heat of a revolutionary moment, that necessity had been historically self-imposed in a way that we in Platypus cannot now, and in some sense will never claim to be able to do. For as Richard noted last night, our slogan, "The Left is Dead," means just this. There is now no viable project of reconstituting revolutionary continuity. 2 decades prior to the definitive crisis of Marxism in 1918, Edward Bernstein had argued that the development of capitalism under the force of the organized labor movement had rendered revolution obsolete, separating what he viewed as legitimate and ongoing struggles for the improvement of the living and working conditions of the working class, from the supposedly quixotic and distracting goal of socialist revolution, Bernstein took his ground on the facts. There were tangible gains to be pointed to, gains that revolutionary adventurism could only endanger, Bernstein forcefully argued. But the facts of tangible reforms won by the organized working class in Germany, Luxembourg retorted in 1900, were not under dispute. Not only did she assert her own commitment to the political pursuit of tangible gains for the working class, she argued that it was solely in and through reform that revolution could be pursued. That is, Luxembourg understood the relations between reform and revolution to be constitutive of the Marxian project, because they alone can reveal to the working class the urgency and prospect of socialist revolution. Reform pointed beyond the facts to the reality of capitalism. Drawing on Marx, Luxembourg characterizes the process, the defeats and victories of working class politics as potentially preparatory for revolutionary politics. Only in this way can the working class constitute and work through reification, deepening its grasp of a total social process that this very deepening constitutes. As Marx would analyze in Das Kapital, working class self-subjectification in political struggle was a constitutive moment in the very actualization of the category of capital. Marx and Engels are commonly quoted to the effect that the German workers' movement inherited the legacy of classical German philosophy. What is less well understood is that the global proletariat first inherited British political economy. In his 1864 inaugural address to the International Working Men's Association, Marx identifies the moment in which bourgeois thought came to an end as a philosophical project, an event of world historical significance, not least for its effect on Marx's own thinking. I refer, of course, to the passage of the 10 Hours Bill. After a 30-year struggle fought with almost admirable perseverance, the English working classes, improving a momentous split between the landlords and money lords, succeeded in carrying the 10 Hours Bill. The immense physical, moral, and intellectual benefits hence accruing to the factory operatives, half yearly chronicled in the reports of the inspectors of factories, are now acknowledged on all sides. Most of the continental governments had to accept the English Factory Act in more or less modified forms, thereby allowing the German proletariat to inherit German idealism, arguably. And the English Parliament itself is every year compelled to enlarge its sphere of action. But besides its practical import, there was something else to exalt the marvelous success of this working men's measure. Through their most notorious organs of science, such as Dr. Uhr, Professor Senior, and other sages of that stamp, the middle class had predicted and to their heart's content proved that any legal restriction on the hours of labor must sound the death knell of British industry. This struggle about the legal restriction of the hours of labor raged the more fiercely, since, apart from frightened avarice, it told indeed upon the great contest between the blind rule of the political economy of the bourgeoisie and the social production controlled by social foresight, which forms the political economy of the working class. Hence, the 10 Hours Bill was not only a great practical success, it was the victory of a principle. It was the first time that in broad daylight the political economy of the bourgeoisie succumbed to the political economy of the working class. If the political self-constitution of the British working class made possible Marx's critique of political economy, by Luxembourg's day, social democracy in the Second International had pushed political economy and with it the conditions of European labor far beyond anything Marx could concretely imagine. Like her great intellectual predecessor, Luxembourg grasped that the capitalist development Bernstein pointed to had to be understood with respect to the growth and development of workers' politics itself. Gains are the reified product of overcoming reification, the practical working through of Das Kapital. In a famous passage in the preface to The Philosophy of Right, in which he insists upon what we might term the realism of dialectical philosophy, Hegel disclaims the project of erecting fanciful conceptions of what ought to be, defining science instead as the endeavor to apprehend and present the state of the present as something inherently rational, cryptically pronouncing mid-paragraph the Aesopian phrase, hic rhodus, hic saltus. In Reform or Revolution, the pamphlet she had written as a critique of Bernsteinian revisionism, Luxemburg quoted Marx in the 18th Brumaire of Louis Bonaparte, echoing Hegel's reference to Aesop when, with reference to the constitution and overcoming of reification, she wrote, quoting Marx, "Bourgeois revolutions," wrote Marx a half century ago, "like those of the 18th century, rush onward rapidly from success to success. Their stage effects outbid one another. Men and things seem to be set in flaming brilliance. Ecstasy is the prevailing spirit, but they are short-lived. They reach their climax speedily, and then society relapses into a long fit of nervous reaction before it learns how to appropriate the fruits of its period of feverish excitement. Proletarian revolutions, on the contrary, criticize themselves constantly, constantly interrupt themselves in their own course, come back to what seems to have been accomplished in order to start anew. Scorn with cruel thoroughness the half measures, weakness, and meanness of their first attempts, seem to throw their adversary down only to enable him to draw fresh strength from the earth and again to rise up against them in more gigantic stature, constantly recoil in fear before the undefined monster magnitude of their own objects, until finally that situation is created which renders all retreats impossible and conditions themselves cry out, hic rhodus, hic saltus. And in 1918, Luxembourg faced the very monster magnitude on which the revolution of 1848 first led Marx to reflect. The actions of Luxembourg and her comrades in provoking the crisis of Marxism rendered them the philosophical children of the age. In so doing, they constituted the past 70 years as history, the history of the crisis of Marxism, thereby at the same time obliterating that history and returning them to the moment of the Communist Manifesto. Approaching the end of the Golgotha path of the proletariat's bitter experience and struggle through defeats and victories, Luxembourg had grasped what Hegel viewed as the consolation of philosophy, the recognition of reason as the rose in the cross of time. Alternatively, we might say that in 1917 to 1919, Luxembourg and the Second International Radicals actualized the crisis of capitalism described by Lukács at the end of Reification and the Consciousness of the Proletariat. The decisive crisis period of capitalism may be characterized by the tendency to intensify reification, to bring it to a head, roughly in the sense in which LaSalle wrote to Marx, Hegel used to say that directly before the emergence of something qualitatively new, the old state of affairs gathers itself up into its original, purely general essence, into its simple totality, transcending and absorbing into itself all those marked differences and peculiarities which it evinced when it was still viable. This was the moment when the emancipation of the working class meets compulsory labor. Rosa Luxemburg's position in 1918 was nothing so precarious as our own. For in returning to 1848, Rosa Luxemburg left the past behind to stride towards a future that, since her death, but a few have been able to hold in view and none to approach. What we require to sweep away the period that intervenes between us in 1918, 1848, we cannot and will never be capable of rendering the 20th century history. As Richard remarked last night, the history that necessitates Platypus is inaccessible to us. I wish to conclude these brief remarks by echoing Lukács' statement in his 1922 preface to History and Class Consciousness to the effect that it is our task to understand the essence of Marx's method and to apply it correctly. In Marx's theory and method, the true method by which to understand society and history has finally been discovered. This method is historical through and through. It is self-evident, therefore, that it must be applied to itself. And this entails taking up a substantive position with regard to the urgent problems of the present. The unbearable impossibility of our project is that we in Platypus adopt the statement of Lukács as our watchword, and yet we cannot heed its call. We are in no doubt that the preeminent aim of Marx's method is knowledge of the present, and yet we have no present to know. To be sure, capital insistently drones its perpetual now, its demand that humanity produce value or more commonly be denied the possibility of doing so. Inside the workhouse of the present, one can always see the clock, and everyone pushes to make the most of their time. But it's unclear that what's going on is even necessary, and consequently, whether one is being exploited or receiving charity. The first task of Platypus is not simply to put our shoulders to the whirligig of time, but to make sure that in so doing, we labor, constituting bourgeois subjectivity in the struggle with regression. The epoch of imperialist decay, if that indeed is what we're living through, is multiply reconstituted through discontents that now have grown irrevocably opaque. The revolutionary aftermath of the 1920s and 30s swiftly loses its coherence, except when viewed through Trotsky's lens, and yet that lens prompts misgivings of optical illusion, since when applied to objects other than that for which it was ground, shapes distend and colors blur. Supplementing Trotskyism with Frankfurt School critical theory promises a critical digestion of the 20th century, but this too is deceptive, as Adorno and Horkheimer's conversations respecting the drafting of a possible new Communist Manifesto poignantly exhibit. Like Trotsky, the Frankfurt School illuminates what is essential about the 20th century, what we ourselves cannot cease exploring in Platypus, above all in and through our engagements with the desiccated fragments of the dead left, namely that Stalinism is the Marxism of the age of imperialist decay and the authoritarian state. But the failure to actually bring the transitional program to bear on a genuinely political scale rendered absurd the rewriting of the Communist Manifesto in the age of the new left. The 20th century will remain opaque, even as we struggle to find within it the resources to achieve the sort of active forgetting that Luxembourg boldly attempted in 1918, if inadequately. The dying confession of the left will always trail off, breaking off mid-sentence, even as we faithfully record it, microphone in hand. And this forces upon us a recognition that before we can rewrite or even faithfully recopy the Communist Manifesto, the Platypus critique must first rewrite Nietzsche's On the Uses and Disadvantages of History for Life. Just before her death in January 1919, Rosa Luxemburg reflected on the working class's understanding of its historical vocation, its veritable path to Golgotha. Because of the contradiction in the early stages of the revolutionary process between the task being sharply posed and the absence of any preconditions to resolve it, individual battles of the revolution end in defeat. But revolution is only the form of war, and this is another peculiar law of history in which the ultimate victory can be prepared only by a series of defeats. What does the entire history of socialism and of all modern revolutions show us? The first spark of class struggle in Europe, the revolt of the silk weavers in Lyon in 1831, ended with a heavy defeat. The Chartist movement in Britain ended in defeat. The uprising of the Parisian proletariat in the June days of 1848 ended with a crushing defeat. And the Paris Commune ended with a terrible and resounding defeat. The whole road of socialism, so far as revolutionary struggles are concerned, is paved with nothing but thunderous defeats. And yet, at the same time, history marches inexorably step by step toward final victory. Where would we be today without those defeats, from which we draw historical experience, understanding, power, and idealism? Today, as we advance into the final battle of the proletarian class war, we stand on the foundation of those very defeats, and we can do without any of them. We cannot do without any of them. Though in Platypus we have no defeats to guide us towards the goal of constituting a socialist revolutionary political project, by the reappropriation of Marx's method, we might discover the way of generating new ones.
Okay. Good morning, good afternoon. In order to prepare for this presentation, I had to ask myself, what can I offer at the Platypus International Convention that neither Spencer nor Ben can, and yet at the same time complement the presentations? I realized that unlike them, I'm a founding member of Platypus, a participant of that first reading group, which focused on reading the New Left Reader in its entirety. I recommend it as a master lesson on the left and symptomology. More significantly, I am one of the individuals who voted in our statement of purpose. This was the first time I ever voted on anything that had a historical significance. That is, this was the first time my actions would be a deciding factor on whether my vote would have any historical significance. In other words, and please forgive me if I'm too candid today, it was the founding of Platypus that I felt my life could actually be purposeful. I became conscious that I had a responsibility to the historical process, and I was committed to make something out of this awakening. I was not fully self-conscious, however, of the historical task that I had set myself in that moment, as I can imagine many of you might share the same predisposition today. But because of the few months of intense education on the history of the left of the 20th century were now breathing down my neck, I could do nothing but attempt to work towards building an organization whose main goal was the reconstitution of the Marxian left. To return to my question, what can I offer you all that perhaps only a few others can? Only exactly a unique expression of what many others in Platypus can, the unique historical experience of the conception of the Platypus Project, the historical memory of an individual who was politicized by the Platypus Project and came in a very short period of time to understand herself as an organizer for Platypus. That is, I came to understand the need to be concerned with the practical development of the organization. I came to learn the significance of the age-old leftist idea that if your organization is not growing, it will become static and die. The growth of the organization, including coming to terms with the need to develop my own leadership, to develop the membership ideologically and practically, to train new leaders, but also the need for recruitment and interventions with the rest of the actual existing left. During the first year of the founding of the organization, this is 2007, it was not immediately obvious what it would mean to build and grow the Platypus Affiliate Society. We just knew, and perhaps only because Chris Catrone had inspired us to, that we needed to actively do it, and we were up for the challenge. None of us, that is Ben Blumberg, Marco Torres, Pam Nogales, and myself, knew exactly how to go about this. In fact, it was the four of us in the first ORGOM with Chris Catrone as president that we first began to tackle the questions of the practical activities that were adequate to the historical task that we had set for ourselves. This was a period where I learned a lot, and we could only learn the hard way, trial by error. I learned, for example, that there is nothing more enraging and simultaneously depressing than talking to a Spartacist at an anti-war protest. I will sit here talking about the Platypus Project and the Platypus Organization as two different things. The Platypus Affiliate Society, the political organization with chapters, a voted leadership, and a staff structure that executes practical activities, is the means, the form given to the self, to the conscious self-organizing towards the Platypus Project. That is, to make the possibility of the reconstitution of the Marxian left reappear in the horizon. For example, I have for a long time now believed that if someone comes to understand the Platypus Project, they would never abandon it. But now I have come to realize that I need to amend that statement. If someone comes to understand the necessity of the Platypus Project, they will never abandon it. This statement does not mean to imply that once you become a member of the Platypus, you understand the project and thus never leave the organization. It is a fact that a few people have left the organization since its founding. What I mean to imply, then, is that probably those who have left the organization did so because they might have understood the possibility of the project, perhaps even its desirability, but not its necessity. It is a failure of the leadership of the organization that we were not able to convey the necessity of the project. We need to recognize, especially those who have been in the project for more than 2 years, the necessity to offer leadership in the development of new members. Joining the organization is not the same thing as understanding the project. It is only a first step, only a step towards better understanding the project, its historical implications, and a step towards making the Platypus Project possible. Of course, new members cannot do this alone. They need pedagogy, they need leadership, and the practical experience of engaging with the left to come to understand the necessity of the project. I'm going to share two experiences that had made this necessity of the project clearer for me, one quite a few years old and another just last week. Excuse me. The most important practical experience I had in my development as a member, as an organizer, and as a leader in the Platypus organization, that is, when I passed the point where I could never turn my back on the necessity of the Platypus Project, was when I joined the newly founded Students for a Democratic Society. This experience, I must say, was a complete failure. But what we learned there was irreplaceable. There is irreplaceable. Our main task, as I remembered it, was to make an intervention at the level of ideology. We wanted to redirect the conversation to intersect other young and recently politicized individuals and make clear the necessity for ideological debate and discussion in the organization. Of course, we wanted to recruit people to our reading groups and spread the word about Platypus as well. But our goal was to make loosely affiliated members of SDS more self-conscious about the ideological and practical problems facing the organization. We wanted a conversation that would work through the failures of the previous SDS, but we also needed to address the problems with the entrenchment of identity politics, for example, and prefigurative politics. We wanted to engage in critique to offer leadership, but we did not want the critique to be one-sided. We wanted SDS to be critical of itself and to work through its own problems through the debate and disagreement, because we felt that this will offer clarity on ideological positions and disagreements. But we were inexperienced at this kind of intervention. We either came on too strong or came off too soft at all the wrong moments. And retrospectively, we were perhaps even all too naive about what was actually possible. People had already been entrenched in all kinds of misunderstanding and misrecognition of Marxism, Maoism, and anarchism. Anti-intellectualism and ideology proved to be widespread and relentless. Our attempts often provoked hysteria and ad hominem attacks. The point of all this is that whatever the results of our engagement with SDS was, on top of the fact that we eventually did recruit a few people from SDS, it proved that the motivation behind our joining SDS, that of intervening either to offer practical ideological leadership or simply to steer the conversation towards historical self-conscious critique, was the correct impulse. It proved the twofold necessity of our external engagements, of our political organization and our political project. It was a training ground for the development of Platypus members on being the fighting force that we need to be. But it also demonstrated how much the rest of the left needed the leadership to better understand what it was trying to do and how it ought to go about it. Clearly, the old SDSers were inadequate to the task, not simply ideologically, but because they were so fascinated with the refounding of the organization, that is, of the redemption of themselves, that they dared not critique it. Of course, the house of cards was already built on too shaky of a foundation. Now, the second example is a recent experience of a Platypus member being invited to speak at the World Can't Wait organized panel in New York City. The panel, U.S. Empire, Islamic Fundamentalism, Both Deadly, Is There Another Way, asked, if you are troubled about the state of the direction of the world, if you're repelled by both the arrogant assertion of empire and by the government and leaders of the U.S. and the financial backwardness of Islamic fundamentalists, what should you be doing? Laura Lee did an excellent job during her presentation at pointing out the limitations of posing the problem in this way. It really became obvious how her talk and presence on the panel redirected the conversation. But there was a problem. The other panelists were only responding to what she said through knee-jerk reactions. It became obvious that they had not really understood. The discussion part of the conversation proved difficult. Susan Sarah Taylor from the RCP, and her demagoguery was unrelenting. All the old wretched lines and positions were put on the table over and over again. People were in completely different positions from each other, but were barely willing to debate their disagreements. One of the speakers from the Rosa Luxemburg Foundation even went to the extent to claim that what we needed was unity and basically our own popular front. This is the same man who was pro-Chavista and arguing for, yes, I disagree with Chavez for his support of Ahmadinejad, but I still support Venezuela. But what was the most interesting to me was the limited extent of the critique of Platypus that Susara Taylor offered. As Laura was attempting to repose the question of what could have been the role of the left in Egypt, for example, via criticism that the left had now dropped the ball and was back on the anti-imperialism rampage due to Libya, many from the audience began to ask questions more critical of the left and the positions of the panelists, of which Susara Taylor responds, and I'm sort of paraphrasing here, "All this talk that the left is pointless. What we need is to change the world." And it was strange because she physically kind of is responding to Laura, who is sitting next to her, and I realized that this was really the extent of her platypus critique, is that somehow we are not doing anything. So from the audience, all I could feel that I wanted to scream was, well, if the left is to change the world, it must first transform itself. Of course, such a response would have been futile, especially since the whole event was a ginormous mess, but once again reconfirmed the necessity of advancing our project and the necessity of prioritizing these kinds of external interventions, of getting better at our interventions. This experience is not only educational for us, but part of the necessary work of the organization. My point here is that we need to get serious at our task of redirecting the conversation and hosting the critical conversation. Establishing the platypus critique is our immediate task and historical responsibility. So then, how should we think about this question? What is the platypus critique? This question is akin, to me, to asking, what is the relevance of Marxism today? As I have come to understand this, the platypus critique is influenced by five different generations of thinkers. The closest to us is the historical timeline are the post-political, post-Marxist thinkers like Adolf Reed, Moshe Bestone, and even Robert Pippin, along with the Spartacist League. See Richard Rubin's numerous talks, including the platypus synthesis from the first convention, on the relationship of platypus to the Spartacist League. Then, the post-World War II generation of Frankfurt School Marxists, Adorno, Horkheimer, and even Marcuse, including that precious little gem during this period written by Kolakowski on the concept of the left. The Second International Radicals, Trotsky, our last man standing, Lenin and Luxembourg, all representing the high watermark of Marxism. Then there's Marx and Engels, of course, and finally, the early bourgeois radical thinkers like Rousseau, Kant, and Hegel. There are many more influences of platypus, but I think these are essential. What brings them together is a historical emergence of the concept of freedom, the establishment of an international political project that would attempt to transform the world in its name, and the subsequent failure of that project. Theirs is a legacy we inherit, and theirs is a legacy we wish to reconstitute a continuity with. To ask what is a platypus critique is to ask, what role can Marxism play in the present? What can Marxism be in a historical epoch that is entirely devoid of a left and of Marxism as a force to be reckoned with? The way I have come to understand the task of Marxism in the present, it is a very reduced task, considering the circumstances of this epoch, is by the question, how and why are the currently existing political organizations and radical ideologies inadequate to the present? In other words, how are the so-called left-wing social practices failing to become the adequate means to their own ends? How can platypism offer leadership in this manner? The question of what role can Marxism play in the present appears as a theoretical question, but I am quite, to my own disdain, not the best at theory. And for that reason, and due to my practical experience in platypus, which I think is really important as well to the project of Marxism, I will take a practical approach to the question. It is no coincidence that I have in large part played an organizing role in platypus, and it is through my experience with organizing organizations like SDS, among others, that I have best come to understand the necessity for the platypus critique as one that needs to be externalized. It is not the case that Marxism is in large part concerned, is it not the case, that Marxism is in large part concerned with the theory and practice problem and the means and ends problem? Is it not the case in practice of Marxism was only really made actual once the largest revolutionary socialist organizations came into being and that Marxism's high watermark was the moment of world crisis of 1914 and world revolution of 1917. That wouldn't seem to imply that Marxism ought to thrive in moments of crisis, but that is insufficient and misguided. Marxism thrives to the extent that it understands the moment of crisis, that it understands the moment of crisis as an opportunity, that it understands that the need that it needs to be prepared when the opportunity arrives, that it understands even further what it means to be prepared at every different expression of the ever-present and evolving crisis, how to best move towards revolution at every given turn of history. Now, we are far from a similar kind of historical moment than the one in the Second International Radicals, to really even understand the moment where these were pertinent questions of Marxism. But is there an essential kernel to these questions that might guide us in the present? What kind event is Platypus Project offering? The reconstitution of the Marxian left. In light of the historical fact, however, that the Marxism that should have been has been obliterated off the face of the earth, how can one begin to even plant the seeds for the reconstitution of a Marxian left? I'm almost done. But returning to the early Marx, to the Communist Manifesto, to the meaning of the ruthless criticism of everything existing, many can say, perhaps this offering is too vague. More immediately, then, what are we to do? How are we to find our way in the fog of barbarism back to the dawn of possibility? How are we to regain the project of freedom? Well, we begin by attempting to regain an understanding of the Marxist concept of freedom. But that, too, is perhaps too vague. Perhaps we can begin by understanding how the current left, and more specifically how the current Marxists, are completely inadequate to the task of regaining an understanding of the concept of freedom. How is it that the current socialist revolutionary organizations or parties are inadequate to their tasks? We need to ask, how is it that current socialist revolutionary organizations are inadequate to the tasks they have set for themselves in light of the history of the present? At least we in Platypus are willing to recognize how currently existing Marxism, including the form given to it in Platypus, is entirely inadequate at attempting to reignite the project of freedom. In that way, we have come to understand the necessity and the desirability of that project, but have yet to convey its possibility. One of the reasons a figure like Lenin has so much to offer us is because he always knew, and this is just why he's interesting to me, he always knew how the means to an end were historically contingent, that every political line, every tactic was always based on the needs of the moment. Different tactics and strategy are always contingent on the historical context. So, thus, because of historical change conditions, what does Platypus do in the current world that we live? Even a year from today, if we're affected in the work we set out to do in Platypus, or even if we fail, Platypus will have to reconsider how we move towards a reconstitution of Marxism. But we also need to better follow through on the question of intervening on the left and hosting the critical conversation, and yet always keeping in mind the means to our end will always be historically contingent on the capacity to affect the historical process and historical consciousness. The organization is the form of mediating our practical work or making our ends possible. It is entirely conceivable that our goals will advance and shift based on how much we as an organization are able to shift the conversation. And at every given time, we will have to be willing to reconsider the way in which we do such work. So where to begin? It is not enough to simply critique the rest of the so-called socialist organizations for how inadequate they are to the present and to practically fulfilling their own ends. What we can do is bring them into a conversation of critique. We must make them recognize the need for critique, fulfill what we were unable to do in SDS, in other words. Our immediate task is to host the critical conversation. These socialist organizations are so stuck in the old ways and so set to stick into the course. They're so desperate, in fact, so powerless, that they cannot even conceive of giving an opening to criticism. For that will mean derailment, submitting to the failures of defeats, accepting the helplessness. This, of course, is not an easy task. The fear is that the moment they open up the floodgates to critique, the house of cards will fall. But the house of cards fell decades ago, and not even the ghost of it remains. And if one digs under the rubble, perhaps, if one is willing to recognize that the house has fallen, one can actually dig through them and find, perhaps, its foundations. Perhaps, then, there's a possibility of rebuilding and making the possibility of Marxism actual. It is not enough to critique the RCP and the ESO at all. The point is to host a critical conversation with these organizations, to make them recognize and become part of the critique. Our immediate task is not so much to make the revolution happen, because that would be delusional at this historical moment, but to plant the seeds, to lay the new foundations that will make the world revolution once again possible, desirable, and necessary. So, what will you do? How will you become an integral part of an organization that aims, 1 year from today, to be a step closer, to imagine the possibility of world revolution reappear in the horizon?
This is the first one, and then this is the second one. I'll just tell you first, second, your hand.
Okay.
Okay, my microphone's not on.
Are the microphones on?
So for reasons that you'll see, this is called Night of the Living. Imagine someone who looks and acts exactly like a human being, but has no consciousness whatsoever. Although he may seem to enjoy a slice of cheesecake, he experiences no pleasure, no guilt, because he, or perhaps it, experiences nothing at all. This is a hypothetical being known as the philosophical zombie, devised to raise problems with materialist theories of consciousness. If it is possible, the argument runs, for there to be a being molecule by molecule identical with conscious humans, yet lacking consciousness, then consciousness could not simply be reducible to physical reality. Such arguments against materialist accounts of mind date back at least to Leibniz. What is historically novel about the thought image of the philosophical zombie, first developed in a philosophy article in 1974, is the sense that what appears to be living and conscious might really, really be dead, or worse, non-existent. It is in this sense that leads Platypus to declare that the left is dead. When first issued, the proclamation was met with disbelief. There were marches, there were parties, there were politics, there was a left. 3 or 4 years before the group formed, millions marched against the possibility of an American invasion of Iraq. Radical commentators noted with glee that this was the single largest collective action of humanity in its existence. Yet the failure of the entire species to stop a war went first unrecognized, then unexplained, and has now been mostly forgotten. The left, that is to say, is dead in the same way that a philosophical zombie might be dead. It moves, it talks, it walks, but it lacks consciousness. If the left is the zombie, what does that make Platypus? Perhaps we are the only life left on the left, the communist equivalent of a motley crew of zombie hunters in the 2010 film Zombieland, traveling around and blasting the head off of bad leftism with our trusty weapons, Adorno and Trotsky. There is the immediate appeal of battle to this approach, but it misses what I think is of central importance and interest to our project. This is why we insist again and again that Platypus has no line, that we seek to simply host the conversation. What I want to argue today is that hosting the conversation is the form of the Platypus critique, and why this seemingly mild mission of hospitality might be more exciting, more dangerous, more difficult than it seems at first. That it may indeed, for a young person interested in politics, in transformation, in culture, or just in the future of the human species, offer a credible answer to the persistent question, what must be done? What is to be done? What the image of Platypus as the last human misses, this is the Zombieland image, is this, that we consider ourselves part of the death of the left. Platypus's whole practice is justified by this sense of being a zombie, a feeling somehow, and quite paradoxically, that one's own and one's age's thought has a fundamental and unmistakable falsity. But this feeling is not specific to our own moment. In 1750, Rousseau submits a winning entry to an essay contest sponsored by the Academy of Dijon. The prompt asked it whether the arts and sciences had contributed to the advance of the human species, basically. What is novel is not that Rousseau answered no, but the standpoint from which he offered this no. Reactionaries before had suggested that the forms of modernity sapped moral virtue, but Rousseau did not criticize the present from the outside in the way we might judge a movie to be lacking or a friend's personality to be dreadful. He saw himself as a part of this sickness and sought remedy from within. This is to say that his approach was immanent to modernity, and it is this form of self-discontent that has come to be called critique. Platypus's critique comes with a date, 1917. The importance of the date and the seemingly fetishistic importance with which we lend to the figures associated with it, Lenin, Luxembourg, Trotsky, the infamous LLT Troika, could suggest that the group seeks to hold ourselves in some sort of unholy Trotskyist, Bajouian, Adornoian synthesis in fidelity to the event of 1917. It is, however, exactly the opposite. 1917 matters because of the force of its obscurity. Sherlock Holmes once solved a mystery by recognizing that a dog did not bark. He noticed the power of what didn't happen. And it is tempting to see the 1917 moment as a sort of historical hinge, a time when there was a possibility of something different, something actually happening, and that the falseness of the intervening years, the sense of zombification, comes because our life is false. We should, this is to be say, living after capitalism. Or perhaps 1917 is something like the light in Kafka's image of a room illuminated by a steady, persistent light with an opaque source. Or perhaps we could say that history froze in 1917, and while much has happened, unfortunately, in what follows, in the 100 years or so that followed, nothing fundamentally changed. And what I mean by fundamental here is that the task of the species remains the same, and that 1917 reveals to us the difficulty and extreme urgency of that task. This is the emergency bell, the emergency alarm that Walter Benjamin speaks of. But none of these images are adequate, nor could they be. For 1917 appears to us to be a task of intense obscurity and obscure intensity. But this is also how neuroses seem, and perhaps 1917 simply names a collectively shared neurosis, an inexplicable attachment to a set of long-dead politics unimportant to the present, and unimportant as well in a deeply humorous way. My mother considers the phrase Marxist convention call to be the very height of hilarity, and perhaps it is. But to the extent that Platypus is hilarious, it is only insofar as it partakes in and seeks to raise to consciousness the terrible comedy of our moment. This is the humor that comes out of from a suffering that is at once absolutely unescapable, wholly indecipherable, and completely unnecessary. I'd like to read now something from Samuel Beckett's Endgame. Spencer is going to be filling in his ham, and I'll be clove. Can we mic him?
Okay, fine.
I'll give you nothing more to eat.
Then we'll die.
I'll give you just enough to keep you from dying. You'll be hungry all the time.
Then we won't die. Pause. I'll go and get the sheet. He goes towards the door.
No.
Clove halts.
I'll give you one biscuit per day.
Pause.
One and a half?
Pause.
Why do you stay with me?
Why do you keep me?
There's no one else.
Nowhere else.
You're leaving me all the same.
I'm trying.
You don't love me.
Nope.
You loved me once.
Once.
We're not beginning to mean something.
Oh, wait. That's okay.
Wait.
Okay, here, once.
Uh-huh.
No, I've made you suffer.
I've made you suffer too much, haven't I?
It's not that.
I haven't made you suffer too. I haven't made you suffer too much.
Yes.
Ah, you gave me a fright.
The reason I wanted to do this somewhat strange reading is because of Endgame, Adorno writes that the understanding it can only mean can mean nothing other than understanding its incomprehensibility or concretely reconstructing its meaning structure, that it has none. Adorno wants to rescue Beckett from the enthused and familiar reading of as an absurdist dramatist, illustrating the fundamental isolation, loneliness, and confusion of life after the death of God. Such dime store existentialism misses the self-enclosed and enigmatic quality that characterize or even constitute Beckett's achievement and could potentially contribute to knowledge of the present. If, as Adorno suggests, the play forms a riddle, then the task is not to try to unlock the riddle, but to understand why the riddle persists unsolved. This is what Adorno means by concretely reconstructing the meaningless. For while Endgame is a bourgeois drama insofar as it concerns a family and its dissolution, and therein shares a shape with Ibsen's Doll's House, It is a bourgeois drama where the grandparents are confined to rubbish bins and starved to death during the course of the play. The father sits immobile, wearing black glasses and a blood-soaked handkerchief on his face, and his son, perhaps adopted, or perhaps not his son at all, has a red face and limps wildly around the room. Yet somehow, despite the apparent obscurity and inwardness of Endgame, it comes to matter, this obscurity, and it is the force of this obscurity that Adorno seeks to understand, and to understand historically, to grasp what the overbearing but inexplicable significance of this idiocy indicates or expresses of our moments. This brings us back to the problem of hosting a conversation. For if Platypus's sense that 1917 names the obscurity of the present, then this obscurity is itself obscure. This is to say that many on the actually existing left, that for many on the actually existing left, there seems to be more direct and satisfying ways of resolving the problems of the present. You know the different options, and you've heard them sketched out this weekend. So the importance of our approach cannot simply be assumed or proclaimed against propositions to have a program to reforce the left. Because a psychoanalyst simply can't tell his patient that a repressed and undigested childhood trauma caused his neurotic fear of intimacy. The connection must be worked out, recognized. Indeed, the image of a large platypus sitting the existing left on a couch and asking, "What did you mean by that?" captures a significant dimension of our practice. In our fora, in the PR, in the convention that you've been to, we invite the left and try to ask the questions that will prod out this recognition of the incapacity. But there is a limit to the psychoanalytic analogy, and that is that Platypus itself is also the patient, so that all the reading groups, the discussions, the planning, the internal element of Platypus, we seek to work out and test these problems, to work through the opacity of the rich and disgusting conglomerations of symptoms called the present. This helps answer the question of why we have no line, no program. For to make political demands means to abandon one's interest in recognizing symptomology of the present and simply become a wholly unconscious symptom. There is an immediate objection to this that needs to be raised. At times, it seems as if Platypus does put forward a given position, some sort of infamous hybrid of Trotsky and Adorno, but is misleading to see this uncomplicatedly as a line, for a line seeks to motivate and direct action, whereas our interest in the radicals of the Second International and the Frankfurt School comes not from their capacity to lead, although the prospect of an actual sect with this Trotsky Adorno line would actually be hilarious in a novelistic fashion. These figures matter to us because of their provocative power. They seem to have to produce a kind of recognition of the problem that, say, Maoism or post-structuralism does not. Nietzsche's image of philosophizing with a hammer is often misread, taken to imply some sort of wild smashing. Nietzsche insists against this, that the hammer he speaks of is not a sledgehammer, but a tuning fork. What Platypus does, so to speak, is tap the present with these disturbing questions and hope that the tone, the music, or the dissonance produced will somehow, by someone, be recognized. But why, in an age of such absolute and base suffering for those lucky enough to be exploited and for the countless many who are not, what might something like the recognizing of the obscure symptomology of the left through hosting a conversation be morally or intellectually adequate, let alone an answer to the pressing question of what must be done, what should be done, of course, depends on the problem. Cure depends on diagnosis. For the problem is not suffering, but unavoidable suffering. The persistence of the present, despite its absolutely obvious unnecessity. Conditions for revolution are not simply ripe or even overripe. They are rotting on the ground and engulfed with worms. To propose yet another method for left regroupment for a new left misses this point. To say that the Platypus critique seeks recognition of our present incapacity seems very modest. But it is characteristic of the present that not only does it deny its own inefficacy and idiocy, but in some sense seeks to adhere to it, that it seeks to love its own symptom. Thus, to really achieve the recognition may take more than it seems, and it is this task that continues to drive and constitute our organization. While I'm uncertain if Platypus can actually be argued for, it seems to me that if you share our recognition of the present as a zombie world, and wish for this situation to be recognized, then, as dispiriting, exhausting, and enraging as any kind of organizational work can be, it is necessary and you should join. Even more, I would like to argue that the project, as gloomy as it is the only honestly hopeful one in the present. And this, again, brings us to Beckett.
We're not beginning to mean something.
Mean something? You and I mean something? That's a good one.
I wonder. Imagine if a rational being came back to Earth. Wouldn't he be liable to get ideas into his head if he observed us long enough?
Voice of rational being.
Ah, good. Now I see what it is. Yes, now I understand what they're at.
Clove starts and starts to scratch his belly with both hands. Normal voice.
And without going so far as that, we ourselves at certain moments, to think perhaps it won't all have been for nothing?
Only the possibility of a future rational being of uncertain origin would hold the possibility of redemption, that all this endless suffering and stupidity and boredom of the human species might amount to something. It is out of loyalty to the future, to the possibility of this future, that inspires the Platypus critique of the present. We are not the ones we are waiting for, and this recognition, as pessimistic as it might be, contains the only honest hope for a completely dishonest time. Because not only is there a pessimism of strength, there might come to be a strength of pessimism, to think, perhaps, it won't all have been for nothing.
I'd like to take questions from the floor. We'll have about 15 minutes.
Sorry, so I'm talking about what happened last night. So Brian Palmer was responding, supposedly the three of them. He completely passed over Jason Wright, the IBT guy, said, well, I think I'll pass on Jason, which is essentially saying, well, you're like this crazy irrelevant sectarian. And then to Mike McNair, he like responded in a kind of defense of Trotskyism against Mike McNair's Stalinist cheap shots. And then to me and to the Platypus Thesis, he said, well, you know, I found like a lot of what Richard said fascinating. It gave me a sense of the Platypus Thesis. But then he criticized like this idea that like you could separate, like I was going to explain how we got here without saying what is to be done. And then afterward, I'm talking to him, and it's a sort of collegial conversation. We're talking about like the Socialist Workers' Party in the 1940s and the response to the Goldman-Mara tendency by Cannon. And, you know, it's this academic conversation about the minutiae of Trotskyist history. And the thought that goes to my mind is, like, well, what is this Marxist academic, who's a good Marxist academic, doing in the classic Marxist sense? In other words, he's this man who is studying Marxist history and studying this history, but isn't like applying it in the same way that the people he's studying is doing. So what I felt was that his response to platypus was not a response of non-recognition, but actually a response of recognition, that there was actually a way in which we were just saying honestly something that he knows all the time in terms of his own work. That was my comment. But I'd like to hear how platypus has changed you or how you've changed your sense. Mm. Sorry I took so long.
I'm sorry, can someone handle the mic?
My question is...
hear from the panelists with respect to...
It's actually really related to what Richard asked.
Okay.
I mean, it's this recognition aspect to the resistance to platypus and in the zombie metaphor. I was just wondering, there is a bad faith element, like Adorno references with in relation to like this false classlessness of society in the conversation. Like, he's talking about his dad, and he's like, he knows full well that it's a swindle, but participates in it. So it's sort of related in the sense of that there is recognition in the resistance to platypus and how that comes to bear on what you were talking about.
So in response to the question about recognition, I mean, I think Adorno is the first person to recognize that there's a possibility, and this in Lukács too, but let's say that there's what gets recognized at some point in or around this 1917 moment is the possibility of having a form of knowledge that's apparent, but like a false forms of recognition. And I think to some extent Adorno's critique was sort of devoted to working through those. So yes, I mean, it may be the case that people feel like they, I mean, I've had this experience at the Left Forum where I gave what I thought was going to be a contentious presentation on Rosa Luxemburg and her complete uselessness, like and her inadequacy of the present, and everyone in the room, I mean, it seemed to take effect. I don't think that means that it succeeded. I think it probably meant that it didn't succeed. Insofar as I think we're understood, I think we're misunderstood. I'm not sure how, it's a difficult question to ask. I mean, about the small zombie thing, zombies not realizing that they're conscious, I think it's the same tension or contradiction that comes between the two parts of Platypus's The Left is Dead and Long Live the Left, which is if the left is dead, why would you say to long live it? I mean, to believe that something dead could have a life means that you believe zombies could become conscious themselves. As for my experience in Platypus, I became very disenchanted with it. I thought it was a waste of my time, and I left the group for a little bit. It was the force of the, I think I realized very viscerally what I was speaking about, the wasteland of the present. I mean, it's not that Platypus is any less a wasteland, but I wanted to be in a place where this was not only recognized, but sought to transform it. And so what the sort of last 2 years have indicated is that it's not impossible, that it's something that could perhaps happen.
That I have a similar answer to that. If anything, over time, especially in the last 2 years, the possibility of the project has become open in a way that perhaps before we were always kind of conscious. Of course, the task is still daunting. Every day it's more daunting because we recognize that it's possible. So it's still increasingly daunting. But I think we've grown, and I think we've done things that 5 years ago we didn't really know that we were capable of doing. And so there's sort of more possibility available in the present.
Yeah, I'll just briefly comment on the last 2 years. I mean, I think that, can you not hear me?
Yeah.
I mean, of course, 2 years ago, I was made the editor of the Platypus Review, and soon after that joined the Orgcom after really having a very sort of incidental and friendship-mediated relationship to Platypus. And what I've experienced in that time, and also leading a reading group, is the constitution of the project. In the sense that the nature of my participation in pedagogy in the reading group, participation in the PR, etc., really has ceased to be irrational in the way that it was in the beginning. That people responded at the level of that the organization really wasn't constituted, even though the forms were sort of paid some sort of lip service to. Whereas now, you know, it's the and I think about this a lot. You know, what is Platypus going to mean when we've constituted ourselves as comrades for each other in a way that we really hadn't 2 years ago? What's that mean in terms of the pedagogy moving forward? What does that mean in terms of our activities? And that's the main difference that I see in the last 2 years.
Speaking here from the gentleman who already has the microphone. If there's anyone else who wants to ask a question, please raise your hand. Okay.
So this is this is primarily a question from Ben, but not strictly, because I think it's relevant to the other two presentations as well. So in some ways, the taking up of Endgame and Adorno and Endgame specifically, I think raises the issue of the Frankfurt School, their post-war moment, versus in relation to the present. And the sort of the meanest criticism or the biggest problem I see in your presentation is it sounds sort of exactly like what the Frankfurt School was trying to do 50 years ago. And the question then is what it means. I mean, is that, are we just trying to do exactly what the Frankfurt School is trying to do? Or what kind of changes, under what change conditions does it mean to take up that project? And in what ways does the failures of the Frankfurt School in some deep way to actually manifest, I mean, maybe to keep alive the bare slim memory, maybe they were successful at a moment there, but their failures to relive Lenin or be faithful to Leninism. I guess I'm just wondering sort of more generally how what the Frankfurt School's project was in the post-war period is related to what we're doing in the present and what it means to take up that mantle, quote unquote, what it means to even repeat it.
Sure, I don't think the question of the failures, I mean, you know, there's this cliched quote about the French Revolution not being complete, whatever. I mean, I think the thing that's actually not complete is the legacy of the Frankfurt School. I mean, so to some extent, that is part of our battle, you know, not seeing what they were doing as a failure or depolitical. So in that sense, like, that's not a way to answer the question. But the difference, I think, has to do with this necessity we have of hosting the fact that the way our critique works is not the possibility of sort of like a intervention, an intellectual intervention of the way that Adorno made in post-war Germany, I think is, I don't think that, though we may have gone down further down the hole than that, I don't think that's possible. And this is why this hosting, I mean, this is, like, literally, this is why I stress that we are, like, as dead or zombified as everyone else, because it is, it's actually just much more, not about trying to critique forms of misrecognition in the present, but to actually make them appear. So to some sense, the task is almost more dire and prior to that. Oh no, that's a rhyme, but the answer, the very specific answer is three words, hosting the critique, hosting the conversation.
Can I just make one point? I mean, because Chris brought up,
sure, but I think you have to realize that what they were doing was they had a target, they had an audience, they were connected in some ways to this, in opaque ways, to the like problem of Marxism mediated through like certain philosophical forms, and they had that, they still were linked to that moment in a way that we don't have, and the snapping of the umbilical cord is, I think, what necessitates this sort of like almost self-effacing or like insistence on not knowing things.
Okay, everyone with a question, please raise your hands. Let's see. Could we hear from the gentleman all the way in the back with the, yes.
First of all, thank you all very much. That was absolutely fabulous. I think there needs to be more absurdist theater integrated into more of the panel. I think that would actually be a lot more digestible.
It's all absurdist theater.
That's exactly the thing. That's what makes it so great. But I'm very interested by, you know, this whole notion of hosting the conversation, hosting the critique, and just not having a line, because I feel like it embodies that sense of formlessness, which I think is very important, because, you know, we are all, you know, the left is dead, and yet long live the left is kind of this desolate, beautiful wasteland, you know what I mean, this lotus growing from mud and concrete. It's very nice. But I feel like that sense of not having a line is, in that sense of formlessness, it gives us sort of the ability to constantly be relevant, because we have to constantly be kind of forming into something else, constantly adhering to the present. But my question is, given the fact that this is sort of the goal of like hosting the conversation, of having this sort of critique of, you know, being dead and recognizing that we're dead and trying to do something about it in any sort of sense, do you feel like ultimately the goal of Platypus in that sense would be to ultimately annihilate itself in the sense of kind of no longer existing because of the fact that we've reached a certain point to where we've ruled out our own necessity as an organization?
Absolutely. We don't. The Platypus needs to not exist in 10, 20 years. Maybe it's going to be harder to get it done in 10 years, but I definitely believe that we do have to overcome ourselves in order to succeed, to say that we have succeeded in any way. Last night, somebody brought this up. I was talking, and we were drinking. And, somebody did say, so what would it mean that Platypus succeed? And I thought it was a great question, and I was like, I don't think I can answer that right now. But it's a great question. Well, yes, there's more. There's more in terms of, like, our recognizing what our task really is in the moment. Like, I think what I try to say is, like, yeah, we can talk about, really do the RCP thing about, like, what our task is in world revolution, because that's just sort of delusional.
So Richard said that world revolution was our task. I think actually the task is sort of prior to, I mean, yes, in some, of course. but for us, it's actually about being able to say world socialist revolution non-ironically, because it's a...
All right, keep your hands raised. I'm just trying to...
If I could, Greg.
Oh, okay. Keep your hands raised, though.
don't keep your hands raised. I'm going to talk for just a second.
I'm writing down their names so they don't have to keep their hands raised. Okay, those are all the questions that we'll take. Okay, sorry, you're too late.
I just want to say that, and kind of picking up on Jeremy's question, I think it's inevitable that we see ourselves in the Frankfurt School. I don't see how that can be avoided. I don't see how we can avoid seeing ourselves in the Fourth International either. The question of degeneracy, of overripeness, of regression, of working through that, particularly, this is why I emphasize the way in which the failure of the transitional program, so to speak, conditions the Frankfurt School in the 40s and the 50s, that it conditions the question of rewriting the Communist Manifesto. Why it failed is something we can't know, because we can't really understand the 20th century in that way. We understand the failure of Rosa Luxemburg in a way that we can never understand the failure of Trotskyism. And that's the opacity. That's what I meant to say, that there is a meaningful sin, that it's Rosa Luxemburg's confidence that she can assert capitalist development, 70 years of capitalist development, that we just, even in her failure, that was a defeat that could have been a defeat for the future in a way that, in the wake of the failure of Trotskyism, it ceased to be. In the wake of the of the collapse of the 1917 moment. It ceased to be. And so, you know, the whole question of regression and what it would mean to constitute, I mean, in a sense, the what I was trying to suggest is that we would be able to conclude Platypus by constituting a defeat for ourselves, right? By constituting some ground that would allow us to orient ourselves to the present in a way that really won't ever be built on working through the 20th century, and yet can only take that form. And I think this gets to the issues of neurosis that Ben mentioned.
Let's hear from a woman in the white shirt up front.
Hi, my question is more of a methodological one. In terms of hosting the conversation, Platypus uses a very specific language in doing that. Mainly, it seems very highly, highly academic, which seems to limit the reach that you might have, or that we might have. I was talking with another newbie yesterday, and we were talking about how it sort of felt like at points we had wandered into graduate-level philosophy seminars. And I understand that if the project is to revisit the left, the canon that, Laurie, you were describing is really necessary. You need to have a grasp on that and be able to reference it and use it. But at the same time, if it's necessary to have a command of Adorno and Horkheimer and Lenin and Luxembourg and be able to use that sort of off the cuff in order to be able to understand the Platypus critique, I'm wondering how widely accessible that project is going to be, and if that's necessary to the project, or if it's sort of a function of the newness of it and the constituents of it, I guess.
I think that I was perhaps walking around this problem, or in terms of what I could address in my own talk. Like, I don't have Spencer's like grasp on political economy or German ideology, yet I have some sort of grasp of Marx and the Second International Radicals and Adorno and Benjamin, etc. But in recognizing that I have much more to learn from these figures and their inheritance, I also have recognized, which is a main part of my talk, the need to actually engage with currently existing politics at the level in which, yes, you're not speaking past them. I don't like the phrase meeting people where they're at, but there is a necessary kind of attempt that in that interaction, we actually do recognize how to speak and actually like fight or debate. And it is in sort of like, yes, you can't just like quote like Lukács and verification like, to basically make a point about RCP's limited political perspective and or just completely devoid of historical consciousness of the present. And yet somehow my recognition of this comes from having read some of these figures and having engaged on them. So, of course, what we do pedagogically is to work through these figures before, because they have something to offer us. And so it is working through what they have offered us. That is part of the project, but it's only a part of the project. There is no point of doing the reading group, of doing the coffee breaks, or doing all of these activities if it does not have some external function. And it is actually a matter of mediating what we've learned in our interactions with the rest of the left, and is finding a way of communicating that in like outside of Platypus. There is no point of the reading group if we don't find a way of talking outside of ourselves. And it's not just about talking, it's about recognizing the change of the conversation.
Just a small thing. I think there's a necessary and unnecessary obscurity about our practice. It's necessary insofar as the things what makes Lenin or Adorno? It's not exactly that we're interested in like retrieving Lenin or Adorno. It's that Lenin or Adorno are so like they're obscure for the present, and that like the fact that they don't seem to fit in actually is what I think gives them this energy. That they seem to somehow be of a different moment or of a different possibility. But on the other hand, I think this possibility gets lost if our approach stops being symptomological, that is, stops being about hosting the conversation and having a conversation and starts being a philosophy workshop. I don't think philosophy workshops are good philosophy either, so that would actually be an imminent critique to philosophy.
If only in academia they would be having the conversations that we have in Platypus.
One thing I meant by the sort of the purging of the irrationality within Platypus is that I think increasingly the education or pedagogy that takes place within Platypus is sui generis. It takes place completely within the activities that we do, and that renders it constitutes us as an organization in a kind of pedagogical moment where none of us know what the conversation is going to be. So, for instance, if you're thinking about the panel on Friday, the point is not, did you understand what Chris said, right? The point is the conversation that Chris had with the other participants, with Richard Westerman with Andrew Feinberg. Similarly, Richard isn't sort of the voice to attend to. In the panel last night, that this is what I think Ben means by saying that we're a part of the dead left, and it's also exemplified in the PR. It's the reason why articles in the PR are not identified in terms of when the writer is a member of Platypus, because the PR as a whole is the education that we're constituting for ourselves, and. None of these articles would be written in the same way by us in the future if we're each article, each expression of quote Platypus has to be superseded, right, in and through our own activity, and so that's what I meant by saying increasingly there are comrades, there's a project that it's not that this person has like a long background in philosophy. No one learned anything before we constituted this project for ourselves. Or increasingly that's the case.
Now we're going to hear from the gentleman in the blue with the mic. After that we'll conclude.
Yeah, I think this relates to the last question, actually. I was wondering if you three could speak about understanding the Platypus approach as a negative one, in the sense of registering what's missing rather than being able to say what to do. And I think, Ben, it relates to you discussing the way we read figures like Adorno and Trotsky, where we're not, for us, they don't provide a positive program, but rather they register what's missing of the own moment. Also think it relates to the question of inaccessibility. I think, for example, when I was joining the project, the conversations were extremely inaccessible to me, but I came to realize that it was less a matter of intelligence and more a matter of history, that certain things seemed especially esoteric because they had been thrown off the table in their own historical moment. Certain things that could have been taken for granted, certain approaches, a certain history by those thinkers, for me, as a young person growing up in the 90s, that I had no kind of access to that. Actually, it happened at the Trotsky panel yesterday, too, where it was like this kind of fairy tale of these like little internal esoteric stories in a world that I didn't even know existed. And so I think that's what was interesting about Platypus, too, is where I both recognized it as people living in the present yet I'd never met people talking about something like this before. And so maybe connect the inaccessibility of platypus, which might be problematic at times, with actually a potential part of our negative approach of registering what's missing in the moment.
That made sense. I'm not sure if there's a question there that we can answer for you.
It's just a hard question. It is a good question, but it's very, very difficult. I mean, there's so many thought images for doing this. It's like, how do we hold ourselves fealty to the future? How do we describe the things that are like missing from our existence? And obviously, if you could describe them easily, then they wouldn't be missing. They would be present to your existence. This is, I think, that the why this goes to the why we don't have a line thing. Because if we had a line, that would mean we knew like what was there, what needed to be done. And instead, we're actually trying to figure out why we don't know what needs to be done. Why we don't know what is to be done.
Is this working? Yeah. I think that there is a sense in which the project lacks negativity. In that the negativity that, I mean, in a sense, we could, that, I mean, I raised this, there's a kind of implicit comment on what I take to be a kind of Marxian dialectic versus Hegel's understanding of the rationality of the real in my comments, in which, you know, the negativity involved in the constitution of capital is precisely what we lack, right? That the negativity at the heart of in a sense, realizing, constituting, and subjectively recognizing capitalist totality is precisely what's absent in regression. And what it means to, in a sense, achieve negativity is part of how I understand this project. I don't know if, it's a different kind of issue of, you know, in a sense, what's lacking is capitalism, right? What's lacking is a inherently revolutionary reality.
I wanted to try to address that too. There was the first time I read Kant's Critique of Judgment, my response about 100 pages into it was, how horribly have we regressed? And it was just kind of an experience of, I don't fully recognize, in my own recognition, but I know that I'm not fully grasping this in this particular moment, but I could grasp its significance in the way that it would somehow, it would kind of task platypus for me in the way that I recognized that I needed to work through the problems being posed. And this is very important when it comes to figures in the Frankfurt School. And it still is very important when I recognize that more and more, now that I'm a pedagogue in the platypus reading group in New York, the complexity and the serious theoretical problems that Lenin raises. And that these things are not academic and not philosophical necessarily, but they're grounded in Marx, and depends on how you understand Marx as a philosophical problem versus a political problem that's being posed. And so it is with the idea that these are not simply philosophical questions, however they are, but they're also political ones that are being raised in relation to the problem of historical regression as well.
Unfortunately, we need to conclude. Let me invite all of you to join us for our final public event of our convention, a report by Chris Cutrone, incumbent president of the Platypus Affiliated Society, on the anti-fascist versus anti-imperialist left, some genealogies and prospects, starting shortly after 1 p.m. in this building, room 1307. Please join me in giving our panelists a round of applause. I've just been informed that apparently we need to eat. Unlike zombies, we do require some form of...
Zombies eat, too.
What?
One.
Let's say about 1:20 or so. See you there. Do we have food?